Welcome to the Joy of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Jessie Israel. I'm a population health leader, a mom, and an all-around healthcare nerd. Lucas Howell is my amazing husband. He's a brilliant business person, and he does most of the hard work on this podcast to get it out and done and into the world. So thank you, Lucas, for all that you do. As you downloaded this podcast, I know what you're thinking. An hour and a half? No way. But I want to make a personal guarantee that you are going to enjoy listening to Doug Lindsay tell his story. Not only are you going to enjoy this story, but I dare you to try and forget how he spent 11 years homebound and practically bedbound as he formed alliances with people all over the world to research and create the surgery that ultimately saved his life. All of this while taking care of his mom, who was suffering from the same illness. I admit I might be one of Doug Lindsay's biggest fans, but I can say with confidence that if you're looking for a keynote speaker or a workshop leader to pump some passion and inspiration into your organization, then please keep listening.
So today it is such a joy to have with me one of the most inspirational people I have ever met. I met Doug Lindsay at a population health conference a couple of months ago and watched him keep a room full of a couple hundred executives on the edge of their seats for probably 90 minutes. There was not a person looking at their phone. Nobody was checking their email. Everyone was listening and hanging on to every single word he said. There was some laughing, a lot of hope. And by the end of it, myself included, more than half of the room had tears running down their face. So I'm very, very excited to introduce and talk today with Doug Lindsay.
Well, hi, Jesse.
Well, Doug, do you want to start off by maybe just introducing yourself?
Yeah.
And why you inspired us so much?
Yeah, I can just tell you what's cooking and sort of give a 30 or 60 second summary of the journey, and then we can talk about a lot of things. So I'm in the Midwest and I'm just a regular guy. And when I was 21 as a college student, I just finished my junior year and I got sick. And I ended up with a mysterious illness. I spent the next 11 years homebound and bedbound. No one could tell me what was wrong or what would help. And I was able to figure out what was wrong and then develop novel treatments to keep my condition at bay as best I could. And eventually I developed the surgery that fixed me. And so I had to build the medical team to pull that off. And then in the end, it also had to work because, you know, when you're dealing with science, medicine, biology, you know, it's not sales. You can't convince nature that you're right. It actually has to work. So that was the story. And then I got my health back and I went back to school. And now I guess we describe me as a transformational thought leader. So what that means is I try to help people get breakthroughs. I try to help companies and organizations where they're stuck apply new kinds of thinking because I had to do a lot of innovative thinking to get where I am. And besides the surgery, I was able to develop new uses for five existing drugs. Oh, goodness, I bumped the mic there. So that's me a bit in a nutshell. And I guess, I don't know, I will turn it back to you for a moment.
Yeah, let's kind of dive into that. So your story is completely fascinating, and you certainly don't have to tell the whole thing from start to finish, but I would like to get into a little bit and to ask for forgiveness as I interrupt with my many thoughts along the way on when you discovered you were sick. How did you really start that journey to think, maybe I don't have to be sick forever?
Yeah. Well, I had taken so my mother and aunt were sick for most of my life. My mom was a math and chemistry double major, and she was the research assistant for the chairman of biochemistry at Washington University here in St. Louis at the med school. So she was a researcher. She worked for a few years, and after she had me, she was unable to work. But even while she worked, you know, I mean, the days would take a lot out of her. She was exhausted. She was in pain. She would come, you know, crash at the end of the day. And so my mom and my aunt both got sick in their 20s, and no one could come up with any answers. So for my entire life, my mom and my aunt as well were going to specialists and coming home with no answers. Everyone could see that my mom was a small, frail woman with muscle rigidity, with rigid, cramping muscles, and that she was very ill. But they couldn't even tell her what kind of condition she had. So in a sense, she had no medical home. And I cared for her throughout the course of my life. And I would also do things like, you know, in the summer, I would go down and tie my aunt's shoes every day because, you know, having your shoes on is a great way to be safe, having a nice, you know, having them fit well. And so, you know, it was, so I grew up around my mom with, you know, who was struggling and had no answers. And
did you go
I liked
to doctor's appointments with her
sometimes,
and,
sometimes,
and
yeah.
Try to convince the doctors to do more, or I guess as a child, did it frustrate you or make you angry to see that, that there was no solution or that they weren't able to find one?
Well, you start with not knowing, you know, you start with the fish not, you know, knowing other than water. So, it's the only mom I have. And so, you know, when we run across things where sexism and people think, you know, women aren't good scientists or some of the nonsense we run into, it's surprising to me because I grew up with a scientist as a mom. And, you know, but I also grew up with someone who was sick as a mom. And so I think I was 9. My grandfather drove my mom to the doctor's appointment and my mom laid in the back seat. And then he went to get a coffee and, you know, she brought me into the appointment. So I wasn't sitting out in the waiting room. And the doctor wanted her to sit in some chair and it looked like a dentist chair type. And she can't sit in that. She has a bad back. And he was pretty insistent and, you know, wanted her to sit in the chair and she was going to sit in it. And I'm 9. I was just twiddling my thumbs. And at that point I stood up and said, don't sit in the chair, mom, you know, this is going to hurt your back. And we walked out of there. And, you know, so I was in a position where I started to understand that not everyone understood and that education doesn't always equal listening or insights. So that was, you know, I mean, that was at that point, I felt enabled and sort of empowered enough to speak up on behalf of people who needed help.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you?
Yeah. Oh, so the way that fit into the story. Yeah. So the way that fit into the story is after my freshman year in college, when I was going to be a biology major, I went to WashU Med School and I looked at their journal databases and I couldn't even read the titles. And that, you know, I went there to see if I could find something that might be useful or help my mom because she couldn't leave the house. She couldn't do research like that. And I could go to the, you know, I could go there and look. And I got there and realized that I couldn't even read the titles. And so I had to come home and go on with my life. And then after my junior year in college, I took a summer biochemistry research position at the University of Kansas. And when I was there, I got sick. And I came down with what we thought was mono, and I came home, and I spent the summer resting and such. But in the end, I got worse instead of better. And so that's sort of, I made it to one day of my senior year in college, and then I had to drop out. And I came home, and it was pretty clear to me at that point that I probably had what my mom had. And that was terrifying.
I bet.
And so, you know, so that was remarkable. But my job at KU was, you know, reading journal articles and such and, you know, outlining the experiments I was going to run all summer, which didn't happen. So I had taken biochemistry and molecular biology and genetics and such. And so now the way I describe it to people is I knew how the chess pieces moved. And that is a big difference when you look at a chessboard. You can get better at chess if you know how the pieces move. If not, you face what might be an insurmountable hurdle, unless you can learn from there. So when I got sick, I went and saw the round. I did the rounds and I saw a bunch of specialists and they couldn't tell me what was going on. I had a doctor, you know, my neurologist, she said I had MS and I tried to comfort her and let her know I probably didn't. And, you know, it was one.
You comforted her.
Yeah. So she's giving me the look like, oh, you poor thing. You don't realize that you realize. And I'm giving her the look like, it's okay. I probably have what my mom has, which is bad. But I can guarantee you don't cry because I have MS because I probably don't. And so those were a difficult set of appointments where I just made the rounds and we came back with no answers.
Yeah. What'd your mom think?
I know she was sad because she felt like she gave this to me. And that was difficult for her throughout.
Did she ever try to stop you from your pursuit of trying to fix yourself? Like the neurologist, give you the puppy eyes, like, it's okay, Doug, you don't need to try? Or was she always in your corner, I guess, as, yes, let's try, let's see what we can do?
She was still trying. So throughout my whole life, she was reading things like Dr. Donahue's column in the newspaper and, you know, ripping the, you know, having someone cut out the page or ripping out the little piece and saving it. Because when there was no internet and when you couldn't leave the house, Parade magazine, the newspaper, you know, columns, you know, little lightweight things that she could have sit on her lap while she was in the bathroom, that was what she could do. So in the 80s, she got all of her records together to go to the Mayo Clinic and was too sick to go. But she found herself as someone with a research background and all of her medical information. And so she went through all of her records and saw that over the course of years, her T4 thyroid hormone level in the blood was dropping year after year after year, but the TSH wasn't rising. And so to a casual observer watching, you know, getting a snapshot of a normal TSH and a T4 in the normal range, that did not attract a lot of attention. But to somebody who was able to sit this side by side over the years and say, watch this dose, watch this level drop and watch the other not rise. You know, then you are able to read and find out that 10% of thyroid problems originate at the pituitary or the hypothalamus and originate from the body not being able to ask the thyroid gland to do more. And now you're in a position where my mom was able to find that my family would benefit from thyroid medication when the doctors had missed it. So when I get sick, the idea, even though I'm a 21-year-old college dropout, the idea that I might find something they missed was confirmed by me being 9 and knowing that you can't sit in that chair, Mom, and was confirmed by my mom being somebody that the world would dismiss, but who could compile data that was hard to dismiss.
Mm-hmm. And who was the first person that came into your corner? Who did you find first?
So,
partner with this.
Yeah. So I went around the horn, and after we came up with no answers, I started reading, and I thought, I will look for answers and I'll do my job as a scientist. You know, I will see what I can come up with. So I read, you know, a 2000 page endocrinology textbook and a 1000 page physiology textbook. And I found I was leaving the campus one night when I was still well, and there was a red book sitting in a milk crate next to the trash can. And it was big and thick and looked fancy. And it was older in the sense, or, you know, it was beyond the level of marketing. So there were no flashy pictures on the cover or anything. So it was just, like a red woven cover. And you thought, like, what is this? And so people were buying that book because they have to. And it was called The Physiological Basis of Medical Practice. And somebody was throwing it out because probably they had a new edition. So I brought that home with me. And some point in my illness, I actually was laying in bed and saw it in the closet. And added it to the books that I read. And so I got a pharmacology text. And so I sort of absorbed all these thousands of pages of complicated information looking for something that maybe the doctors had missed. And I came up with the idea that there was probably an entire class of autonomic nervous system disorders, that this system, if it started to malfunction, since it controls heart rate, blood pressure, metabolism, and digestion and such, that maybe those things would malfunction if this system did. And so I pieced together info from all the stuff that I had and wrote it up with a little bibliography. And I went to the doctors and they said to me, problems like you describe don't exist. And I said, but they could. Because I didn't know this at the time, but doctors practice from experience. So the idea that a patient has come into their office and theorized a class of disorders that they don't routinely encounter or know anyone who specializes in treating, it's absurd. But to me as a scientist, the idea that there was a complicated system in the body, but that nothing could go wrong with it, that was absurd. Yep. So that was a disconnect. And I'd run my course. I saw a series of doctors and told them that, and that was the gist from all of them. Problems like you described don't exist. So I was at home and I was lost and I realized medical doctors are not the only kind of doctors. PhDs are called doctors too. And so I reached out to everyone that I had worked with, you know, the few people at KU when I was there for a few weeks, the people back at Rockhurst where I'd gone to school. And my mom, since she had worked at Wash U, she said, why don't you call the med school and ask for a bulletin? I said, I don't know what that is. And that is a list of all the classes they teach at the med school, all the faculty, all their research focuses. So I read Wash U's several hundred page bulletin, you know, reading the descriptions of the classes, marking ones that might be of interest to me, finding out who taught them, and then reading department by department all the names of the researchers. And I found a G-protein investigator named Kendall Bloomer. And he was a basic scientist, which is, I still didn't really know what that was, but he was a bench scientist who studied the kind of receptor that adrenaline receptors were. And I just called him and I kind of talked to him for a minute or two and then I left a message and I got a call back from him about 4 or 5 months later. And he was like, I'm sorry, I didn't get back to you.
Wow, so, that's quite the time frame.
So he was the first guy from nowhere who self-selected to be in my corner. And he was with me throughout my journey. And he helped me understand the world of science when it was beyond me to understand the etiquette of something I'd never experienced. But there also, I got a bulletin from the University of Colorado too. And that one was very short. It was about 40 pages. But there was a guy there. I feel like his name was Wiener. I roughly in that category. It started with a W. He might have even been a Nobel Prize winner. There was a really esteemed guy who was from Colorado, who was involved with catecholamines, which are the kind of, you know, chemical that adrenaline and its sister norepinephrine are. And so I called him and he was emeritus. And so he's in retirement and he is on the phone and it was like, who's on first? It was like the Abbott and Costello routine. He is yelling at me and he's yelling at his assistant and he's calling us both you. And so he's like, you need to realize it, bring it. And I'm like, I'm not talking to you. And then it's you. And then, you know, and then it was really. So it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't all phone calls that, you know, with warm people calling back after 5 months. Sometimes it was like, what are you saying? What are you handing me? And I'm like, I'm handing you a logical piece of not you. So he and I did not hit it off into a continual relationship, but Dr. Bloomer became somebody who I could turn to say, here's what I'm thinking of doing. Here's what I'm seeing. And then he could tell me why that was dumb before I screwed up somewhere else. So.
And what was you've had several big breaks, but what was maybe your first kind of breakthrough?
Well, when I got a computer with internet access, I was able to find within a month that there was a nonprofit devoted to these autonomic problems that I contended existed and was told didn't. And that gave me a chance to reach out to them. And this was a lady who had been sick forever. She finally found someone who'd heard of autonomic problems, and she and her husband founded an organization called the NDRF, the National Dysautonomia Research Foundation. And their mission was to disseminate information to patients and doctors. And so she sent me journal articles, but she also sent me the literature that they'd prepared. And they had a lot of the big doctors on their board. So the literature that was accessible to laymen was also medically accurate. And so she sent me stuff, and that got me the lexicon of the field. So if you're searching for sympathetic nervous system disorder, but everything is published under the word dysautonomia, maybe you find it, maybe you don't.
Yeah.
So that was a big break. And now I had their language, not the way I described it as somebody who understands physiology, but is far afield from medicine and is making up terms that are descriptively accurate, but they're not what people were using. So all of a sudden I could get plenty of articles. And I called friends who had now graduated college and were in med school, and they would send me PDFs of the articles I needed. And if I couldn't get those, I would write the authors themselves and ask for a reprint. And so I sort of was everywhere and I read a lot and I came up with an idea for a proposed treatment for the disorder. And I wrote up an abstract and submitted it to the American Autonomic Society to their annual meeting. So this would be a worldwide gathering of all of the investigators and researchers who care about autonomic nervous system dysfunction. And I got in.
Wow.
So I'm a 24-year-old college dropout, but I also learned what it means to be an adult gatekeeper. I was a little sloppy with the bibliography, not with whether the facts were or whether they were cited, but with the colon, dot, blah, blah, hyphen, this, that, you know.
Yeah.
I thought somebody fixed things. So when it was published and there were sort of, you know, like...
grammatical errors or,
there were formatting errors in the bibliography. Yeah. Is one of the first times I learned that there's no goalie. You know, like hockey, there's no goalie. There's nobody making sure that if you don't handle the details in some circumstances, you're going to find there's no one more adult waiting behind you to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was the biggest break, was this chance to go and be in a room full of all of the researchers in the world and be able to speak and be able to have a chance to engage with them. And I'm spending money that we kind of don't have. I mean, I'm sick. My mom's sick. My dad left us. You know, and an aunt died and left a little bit of money. And the part that went to me was going to multiple plane tickets so I could lay across the seats because I couldn't sit for the length of a flight. And so I'm laying across seats on Southwest or whatever I was flying to go to Hilton Head, South Carolina, to go to this medical conference where all these people would be, because I was in the room and I would get a chance to engage them as scientists, and they'd heard of what I was talking about and they'd written what I'd read, and I had an idea and I wanted to see if we could make something go of it. So that was the big break, is getting to meet all of these people.
And what was your original idea, Doug? Did you think it was ultimately the surgery that got you out of this, or did you have a different idea first?
When someone says you have a broken ankle, it doesn't explain how or why it's broken. Mm-hmm. What I did is I described my condition as a sympathetic nervous system insufficiency, meaning that the activity of my sympathetic nervous system was insufficient to prevent the development of the symptoms I had. So I would eat a meal, like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a glass of milk, and then I would get a heart rate of 140 for 2 hours, because the body would send blood to the gut to pick up nutrients, and my body then had a hard time regulating its blood pressure. And it was struggling so much that even when I'm laying down and it's trying to regulate my blood pressure, I've got a heart rate of 140. And so I'm in the position of saying, if the sympathetic nervous system was not insufficient at doing its job, it would be able to cause enough vasoconstriction that I wouldn't get this runaway heart rate just from eating a meal.
Yeah.
So I sort of laid out these symptoms and said, these indicate that my body is not, that the sympathetic nervous system is acting in a way that is insufficient to prevent the development of lightheadedness when I'm standing, of runaway heartbeat, and of these other symptoms. I can't say why, and I can't say what it means or what the cause is, but I can say these are indicative of that. And that's how I sort of framed it in the article. So it was not the parlance they use, but it was a descriptive term to say, is there not a subset of patients, and at least there is because I'm one of them, who we find ourselves grappling with these symptoms because of this inability of this system to do its job. And then I outlined, you know, medications that might be useful, you know, and that was the paper.
Great. And did what happened next? Yes, like, did you start the meds and everything got fixed? Or yeah, I know it didn't,
because I heard put a crown on my head, and it was all, you know, everyone was blown away by this prodigy in the reclining wheelchair. No. So, you know, no, that did not happen. The poster before me was from the Mayo Clinic, and the poster after me was from a scientist who'd flown in from Japan. And David Goldstein, who's neurocardiology section chief at the NIH, was the guy introducing me. Roy Freeman from Harvard was supposed to do it, and you know, he was sitting on a, you know, he was just hanging out. So they were co-chairing or something, this little section. So old Dave comes up and says, here's Doug Lindsay, and he's going to talk about what life's like as a patient or something. So he didn't say or something, but he sort of introduced me as this was going to be a patient story. And all of a sudden I'm talking about the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. And, you know, so it was interesting. I did a good job presenting. And then when I finished, he went, I don't think that will work because blah, 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 blah. And I took the microphone back and went, well, I think you have to think about blah, blah. And he and I started going back and forth until the president of the organization was like, we have other posters. And so that could have been seen as this like, really, dude, this guy hauls himself across the country. He's in a wheelchair. He did this. He gets his moment. He finishes talking. And you're like, yeah, I don't know that that's going to work. Except for he treated me like every other scientist in the room. So when I was back in my hotel room and I had sort of recovered from the fact that I had a chance and, you know, people didn't clap, you know, that was okay. Because you're in science, you're allowed to be wrong and you're just allowed to do your best. I realized this guy treated me with respect because he treated me like everybody else. And so I called his room and said, you know, I love some of the things you were saying. I have some of the papers I was talking about. Can we meet later and talk? And he said, yes. So I met him that way. I met Dr. Coughlin, and who was at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. David Robertson was the founder of the first interdisciplinary autonomic dysfunction center in the world, and that was at Vanderbilt. You know, and I met all of these folks and built some pretty strong relationships. But what I didn't do is find anyone who wanted to collaborate with me. And it was funny, I was there and I was talking to a fellow from Case Western, and my friend Matt, who's a very sharp guy, was standing behind me. And we were talking about the medications, and he said, well, you know, why don't you try them? And I said, well, that's why I'm here, is to find someone to work with. And you could see the shift in his face, like, oh my God, he wants me to do it. I have a job. And so it was important to realize that conference taught me that a good idea doesn't have to be acted on, that these people have no moral imperative to pause their own research that they've devoted their lab to and shift to my focus just because I'm a smart guy and found a paper and had an idea. And that's not apparent, right? If there's a way to treat a disease and you're a doctor who treats it, one would think that you would want to do that. So that's where you go in as just a patient thinking maybe that's how things work. Then you realize this guy's built an entire lab with a specific research focus, and he can't chuck it out the window every time he meets somebody that had a clever idea.
Yeah.
You know, you can't turn your restaurant from Italian to Chinese just because you met a guy that had a great dumpling recipe and then, you know, make it a Brazilian barbecue joint because you found a new sauce that's killer. So that was a learning lesson. But we also got to see his face change. I didn't see it because I was in conversation. But again, it was someone who noticed the change and said, we need a new tack because these folks are freaking out.
Yeah, they don't do treatment, right?
Well, they don't set their judgment aside to do what you say just because you wave an article at them. So, mm-hmm. So that was an important moment. Mm-hmm. That you could be right and still maybe no one would pursue it, and that didn't make them bad. It wasn't personal, you know.
Yeah. How did you stand back up from that? I mean, it seems like that might have. I wasn't there, but I would have felt pretty disappointed that maybe I didn't get to move forward with some treatment. How did you find your way to the next thing where that person might try something?
So as a patient, there is no answer. There's no wrong answer, right? You're not obligated to keep going. There's no apparent answer that's right versus wrong if you're a patient. If you're a doctor, there's no apparent answer that gives you an imperative to keep going. But as a scientist, there is. In science, you run the experiment. 50 learned people's opinions about an experiment that's never been run don't equal having run the experiment. So I was in front of the world's best minds. I made my case for why these medications might help patients like me. Some of them raised their objections, but those objections were not sufficient to solve the issue. They were concerns. They were alternative hypotheses of what would happen. That's not the same thing as actually having done it. So as a scientist, I may have come home crushed and sort of felt quite sad that like I had my shot, I took it, they even listened, they were gentlemen, people paid attention to me, and I still came home empty. That's worse than just getting blown off in some sense. But as a scientist, you were able to hearken back to this thing that in science, we run the experiment. So that was what spurred me. And I realized I would have to keep going, that an idea for a drug to take was not actionable. I now needed more information. And so I had to start delving into pharmacology and you know, pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics. And so these things that I knew nothing about. And so I had to figure out what to do. And I called the professor at WashU who teaches the section on on autonomic nervous system drug pharmacology. So he teaches about asthma drugs and blood pressure drugs and such. And I called him and he said, you know, to find this information, you'd have to go back to articles from the 60s where they were writing review articles about these drugs. And then in their bibliography, you will find the original research, which is articles from the 50s. And so that's what I did. And then we had to get those. And then I had to read them. And I had to read 30-page articles from, you know, drug reviews of comparing all these different drugs within a class, because I needed now to say what dose of if a drug is going to be used for a new problem and it's never been done before, what dose do we pick? And there was no easy answer. And most doctors and pharmacists and, you know, most people will never face that. This drug has never been used to treat this problem. What dose do we start with? And that was what I was facing. So I had to read all this stuff to guess. And that's so that was the next step. And in the end, I found someone local to work with on this idea. And it was not a success, but it showed some promise. And it gave me an idea that basically it let me refine the treatment. And when I came up with a refined treatment for my condition, it scared everybody even more. Because I came up with an idea that said, I would like to be on a low dose home Levofed infusion. And the Levofed, if you're just sitting in your car, you might not know what that means at all. And if you're in medicine, you know a little jingle, which is Levofed leaves them dead. People use this drug in the ICU in a last ditch effort for hours or days to try and save people's lives. But I came up with a new use for it at a very low dose. And I hoped that it could be useful in my case. And so if you approach this as a scientist, Levofed is just the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. It's being released by millions of cells in millions of people's bodies right now, normally. But as a drug, it has a scary reputation. And so that was, again, where the difference between science and medicine bumped into each other. So that was sort of, that was the next hurdle, is I thought this would be useful at augmenting my body's sympathetic nervous system, which was failing to prevent me from getting symptoms like runaway heart rate. And we didn't, while I was talking, I forgot to skip over like actually what my daily life was like. So for that 11 years that I was sick and homebound, I could walk about 50 feet and I could stand for about the length of a commercial break. And I had to write with dictation software when I would do typing because I didn't have the stamina in my arms or hands to type. And I had to talk with a headset because I couldn't hold the phone that long. And to read a book, I had to lay on my side because I couldn't sit that long. So I would prop the book open with my fist and then read the pages that way. And I was in a position where something like changing a light bulb was a multi-step process where I could reach up and take the old bulb out, but I would have to rest before I put the new one in because I couldn't have my limbs away from my body for that long. And so that's the level of impairment that I was living with. I was somebody who could clap a few times and then my hands would itch and tingle like they'd, you know, like they'd sort of gone to sleep. And I had cramping muscles and painful muscles. And it was just a very difficult situation. So I would travel by reclining wheelchair. Someone would have to push me. And this thing ends up being about 6 feet long because I'm about 6 feet long. And so my legs are largely straight out in front and I'm largely laying back like a dentist chair. And they would have to push me around in that. Sometimes then it could sit me up to get into an elevator. And sometimes we didn't fit in the elevators.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm going to use this spot. I know we're going to get back to Levofed here in just a second because that's it is the drug we use that ends up taking people's limbs really to because the vasoconstriction is so strong. But during this time, this 11-year time when you're talking about your day and your life, you had told me about the kinds of foods you were eating, and I found this hilarious and sad and fascinating all at the same time. So if we could just diverge for a second and talk about kind of your daily meals and how you took care of your mom in that state too. I know those are two separate questions, but
yeah, maybe start with the food. And we'll make sure I don't get lost in the sciencey kind of stuff. We've sort of covered the bulk of like how I went from not knowing what kind of problem I had to being able to convince experts that I probably had this kind of thing. So I had a lot of trouble after meals, and it was a problem for years. But it was such a part of life that it didn't seem affectable, you know. And so you'd try cheese slices and Pringles, or, you know, things that were easy to eat. Or you'd do this or that when you were too sick, or you have ham and, you know, a piece of bread. And so we struggled. Well, one Christmas, my friend's mom sent down a plate full of food, and it was brisket and potatoes and, you know, like not much else, a couple of veggies. And I felt better, and I didn't get sick after I ate it. And so through just a notice, I started to zoom in on what is exacerbating things. And so if it had wheat in it, it was a problem for me. I wasn't gluten intolerant. Wheat just was a mess for me. You know, so I couldn't have peanut butter and jelly. If it was sugary, it would be a problem for me. And so I ended up eating a high protein food, and then a starch and some veggies. And so I spent, I guess, from about 2003 till 2011. So for about 7 years, every day I ate bratwurst, rice, peas, and raisins and water. And
I am just falling out of my chair at what you just said. You just said you ate this for
5 times a day, every day, 7 years.
7 years.
You throw in a hamburger here and there with no bun. And realize that if I have too much ketchup, that my heart's going to pound. So too bad. So I had to find foods that I could tolerate and that I could get my hands on. And so that was the thing. Somebody could cook a week's worth of bratwurst for me, and then we could put them in the freezer, and they wouldn't get freezer burn because of the nature of bratwurst versus burgers that would. So that was the thought, is like, you know, I would eat these brats like crazy.
Probably people who would rather just no longer live than eat the same meal 5 times a day for 7 years.
Yeah. And so in the middle, I decided to quote, get healthy, close quote. And I switched to ground turkey. And in 4 days, all of a sudden I could stand for 1 minute with a heart rate of 120. That was a disaster. My life became a disaster. And I said, you know what? I don't understand why, but if it's the turkey and I stop it, it's taken me 4 days to get this sick, basically. By the week, you know, by 4 days from now, it should be waning if it's the turkey. And so we went back to the brats and it went away. And you're like, you know, other people get tired when they eat turkey and they say it's too much tryptophan. I don't know what the heck happened, but I certainly know that my nurse and I could walk into the kitchen, start a timer, take my heart rate, and after 60 seconds of standing, it was 120. And that was not customary. I could usually stand 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes. And so having that diminished by, you know, having my standing time diminished by 80% was huge.
Yeah.
And that was just dietary choice. Just something as simple as replacing brats with ground turkey burgers and being like, nope, back to the brats. It's every day is a baseball game for this guy.
Brats and raisins and it's a funny combination of food. How about taking care of your mom?
I would mix it up. And so every once in a while I would throw a little bit of peanut butter in the rice and with the raisins and the peanut butter. And I called it, this was like, I came up with this idea of a company called Hobo Bachelors, and it was for food, and it was food for bachelors inspired by the recipes of a hobo. And hobos are not bums. These are people that choose to ride the rails and live with the stars as their roof. And so I have a friend who literally would ride the rails from New York to St. Louis, and it's very dangerous. And that was his choice. But anyway, now he's got a great guy and he's a great job. But anyway,
well, he probably would have loved your peanut butter.
He did, because I realized as a hobo, you can't be carrying around glass containers and hopping freight trains. So raisins wouldn't expire. So this was the hobo's peanut butter and jelly. It was raisins, peanut butter, and rice. And you mix them up and eat it.
Oh my gosh, it sounds disgusting, but I haven't tried it, so I can't.
It's like a peanut butter and jelly. So that was sort of, you know, how do you find moments of joy when your life is hard? Well, if you're funny, you know, and you make up something, you do that. So same thing. That was hobo spaghetti. Was I would add a bit of salsa to the rice and the brats, and then you had all the pieces in a way that wasn't going to expire, and you know.
Oh, sounds, I'll add the first one to my life list, but maybe not the second one.
That sounds fine.
All right. What about your mom? How'd you take care of your mom when you were in this period at home?
I mean, I did my best, and we had friends who would help, you know, little bits. People would make a week's worth of food, and then I would just have to reheat them and serve them. And she would eat a lot of things like Rice Krispies, things that she could eat, you know, and have a few peaches, you know, sliced peaches on a cereal in the morning. And she tried ham for years, but then, you know, ended up just eating baby food, rice, cereal and stuff. So she really had a hard life and hard times, and she was always in pain. And I know that she valued having me around, and I valued her valued being around her, but it was hard because we were just very sick. And so, you know, you don't think about things like she could only wear one pair of shoes. And that was it for, you know, because at that point she was too weak to stand differently. I mean, her body, because of her rigid muscles, if you gave her a hug or if you clapped behind her, her body would tense up and cramp up, and she could be in pain for weeks. And that means you can lose abilities. Like, you know, this person could lose the ability to walk if something didn't go well and maybe never get it back. So it was a very high risk life, and it had very low tolerances for change. And that was scary stuff. And so, you know, we just did what we could. Mm-hmm. And she was a wonderful person and very funny and just a very happy, process focused and kind person. So she sort of showed me how to live sick with grace. And that was easier for her because she's nicer than me, you know.
So. I don't know if that's possible. And you guys spent this 11 years is a really long time. I find myself really curious how you gained such a high level of emotional intelligence. I mean, you've really spent a lot of time. It says on your website, you swayed 35 senior faculty members to help you, worked with 28 medical institutions.
Yeah.
And you have a finesse about you of talking to people and not being angry. And I'm really curious how this developed when there was so much time with maybe, I mean, maybe it wasn't, but I assume most of it was you and your mom at home.
Yeah. And then halfway through my illness, we lost power in St. Louis, and in our brick house, there was no air conditioning, and I had to send her to the hospital, knowing that simply the ambulance ride to the hospital would likely injure her to the point that she could never come home. And so about halfway through, she ended up in a nursing home and was there for the rest of her life. And so for the back half of it all, I was here at home, and I couldn't help her directly very often. And so I started reading books about management and signing up for managerial advice email chains and stuff, because I realized my ability to affect the circumstances of my mom's life now was as a manager of the people that could physically help her. So, yeah, I mean, I was alone all the time for the most part, you know, and I'd have people who would come by and help a little bit, and that was nice. And I wouldn't have that many friends come visit. So I might have six a year maybe. So yeah. So how do you get good at all this stuff? Well, one of the most amazing things is somewhere in the middle, I'm going to go give a presentation at that medical conference. And I've realized something. I hate doctors. How the hell am I going to go in a room full of these doctors with no poker face and look them in the eye and basically be like, you know, you and the people like you failed my mom for my whole life. And that was a bad way to build a team. And so I sent my abstract in June. The conference was in October. And I was like, holy smokes, I got a problem. I have no poker face, so I need a plan. And I was reading this book that Dr. Phil put out. And, you know, it had all these little things, but the key takeaway that I had was something is powerful. You can think about your thinking. You can think something, feel something, and then analyze why you felt that way, why you feel that way. And that was a remarkable turning point in my life, because I was always hypersensitive to adrenaline. I always had some kind of medical condition, and I was afraid of my brain at some times. But now I was in a position to realize that I could think about thinking instead of just feeling stuff. And that gave me a chance to dig into what was going on. And I just asked questions and answered them and generated reams of content with dictation software, trying to find out why I think the way I do, why I feel the way I do, and what to do about it. And so that was key. And I also was on my high school newspaper. It sounds silly, but one of the things I did was I'd call up strangers. We would just do an interview. You know, so I would, hello, this is Doug Lindsay from the DeSmet Mirror. I was calling to talk to you about the, you know, Juvenile Offenders, blah, blah, blah Act or something. And I would call my congressmen and senators and, you know, and get, I acted like that meant something. But I developed the skill of reaching out to a stranger, summarizing where I am, what I'm doing, orienting them to why this conversation is happening and what I'm seeking, and then helping people understand that what I was seeking was something that they were free to give. I didn't want them to save me. I didn't want them to be my emotional support and for me to call them 100 times a day or 100 times a year. I was calling because they were the people who had specialized knowledge, and that knowledge wasn't written down, because if it was written down, I already would have found it. So I was calling them with a question that can't be answered by the written record, and they hold the information. And if they don't have it, maybe they know who does. And if we get that information, it might just save my life. And that's pretty compelling. If you spend your life as a researcher learning pieces of information and you realize that what you know could fit as a puzzle piece in this guy's puzzle and change a life, that's why they got into this stuff. And so it was a very, and I called and I'd read their work before I would call these doctors. And so we were starting from this amazing place of talking about things they'd spent years on. And that was, you know, that it didn't always work. There were plenty of people that didn't want to talk to me, but there were plenty who did.
Yeah. So let's maybe, so you did sway them. Yeah. And you swayed them by understanding where they were, right? What they had worked on. Who did you find to, well, first, actually, sorry, I'm kind of all over the place here, but let's go back to the Levifed. You tried it?
Yeah.
Did it work?
Yes. So I came up with an idea for a low dose norepinephrine infusion. And as a physiologist saying, this is something released, this is bioidentical to what's released in my body and in my blood. And in a sense, it is very analogous to someone taking a thyroid pill every day. It's the same as comes in their body, and it's a fixed dose and such. And so I was suggesting a very low dose. And a friend sent me an article. He was up at Mayo Clinic doing a residency, and he sent me this article where people had tried it in Germany and died.
Oh, that's not encouraging.
No, it was not. But they had multiple systems atrophy, which is fatal 100% of the time. And some of these people went from bedbound to being able to walk more than 1,000 feet. And if you're healthy, that's not very far. And that won't even get you from where you're from one part of the hospital to another. But if you can only walk 50 feet, that sounds remarkable. These were people who couldn't stand for 30 seconds. And this Levifed infusion that they had come up with and used was able to help them for their condition. The difference in my condition is I wanted to use it 24/7. They were only using it when upright. I had symptoms while laying down. They had symptoms only when they would rise. So that's the article I had. And Dr. Coughlin, one of the investigators I met at the American Autonomic Society meeting, I reached out to him and he wanted to work with me. And he was from Chile and he was older and he had special experience using drugs like dobutamine and other unusual asthma type drugs in cardiology and in actual animal research. So he had a very specific background, and he remembered an article from the NIH from around 1980 where they had used Levifed infusion for some of the most severe cases of people who couldn't be upright without passing out. And they'd done it in a controlled trial, and they'd had some success. And I said, we didn't have to do the controlled trial and limit it to a tilt table in a lab. We could use a medication pump and a dilute fluid of this and put it through a portacath. We could basically infuse it just like a regular, just like a, you might get saline or a cancer drug. And we could try that. And so that was the idea, was repurposing existing technology and an existing drug to see if we could come up with a new way to treat something as weird as my tachycardia while I was laying. And we could. And so I thought things through. So it was a very low dose and it was very dilute, because if the pump malfunctioned, I didn't want to die and everyone wanted me to be safe. So we thought through what might happen that's bad. And then we came up with ways to manage that as best we could. And I was on that at home for 6 years.
Wow.
And so that's, you know, since some people are on it for hours to days, you know, like, that's, it was unheard of. And when they were writing an article about me for one of the newspapers, one of the reporters called an autonomic expert at the Mayo Clinic. She called me a liar and said I'd be dead. And I said, you can't print that. That's not fair. It's not that it's not fair to me. It's not fair to her as a scientist. She hasn't seen the data, and the data is I'm alive. And you can't pants her in the newspaper and put my name on it. Because it's not fair for her. She needs to be able to have access to the data. And if you're going to create a confrontational situation, which even has a feel-good feel, like, oh, she thought he'd be dead, but he's alive. Like, that's just not fair to a scientist to have them commenting on a situation when there's data that you have access to and you're going to put in the newspaper that they don't have access to as a commenter. So that's sort of, you know, I had to walk that back from the edge of a cliff, because it sounded like a great headline. Mayo says he'd be dead, but he's alive.
But he's not.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
And then from there, so did that get you to a point where you could function normally? I mean, I know, and you started off with that you ultimately ended up having a surgery.
I mean, it stabilized my decline. It let me get from the front door to the back door easier. It let me walk to the car when the car was pulled up and the wheelchair was loaded. It gave me better stability within the realm I could operate in. Now I could shower instead of like crawling up the stairs and just laying in a lump with my heart racing and the room spinning. So it dramatically improved my life, but I was still confined by those limits of being bedbound 22 hours a day, roughly being able to walk about 50 feet, you know, everything worked better. It's just sad that that's what better looked like.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're sitting there with this blessing thinking, well, this is not getting me back to school and back to the future. What the hell am I going to do now? And that's when Dr. Coughlin's testing. So I avoided autonomic testing for years, which sounds crazy if you say you have an autonomic problem, but I needed people to interpret the data correctly, and I needed people to run tests that would gather the necessary data, necessary and sufficient. What was the minimum amount of tests we could run to get what we needed to learn, and what was necessary? And if you weren't going to run all the tests I thought were necessary, I wasn't going to risk that you would miss diagnosing my problem because you didn't run the right tests. And so I didn't get it here in town in St. Louis. I didn't get it anywhere. I had to go to somebody whose work I trusted, because they could leave me sick for life by doing their best, but not running the right tests. Yeah. And Dr. Coughlin was willing to run the right tests. And so they weren't elaborate, but so he operated with a research mindset, but not under research protocols. So, you know, he was sort of the old style doctors who were pioneers in a field where they're writing case studies about unusual patients. And those kinds of case studies eventually spur larger trials and larger studies.
Yeah.
So that was it. I went to Birmingham and I saw Dr. Coughlin, and he ran a tilt table test on me, which is where they strap you to a table, tilt you vertically to simulate the strain of upright posture. And my heart rate got to 170 within 7 minutes. I had sweat through all the restraints. My blood pressure had risen and then fallen, both systolic and diastolic. I was losing consciousness and starting to struggle against the straps. And there was nothing more terrifying in my life. And they laid me back down. But what he also did was run blood work. And they weren't going to do that in a lot of places. And the blood work showed that my adrenaline levels, my epinephrine levels, were way higher than they ought to be. And we thought, maybe I have an adrenaline tumor. Maybe that's why my body, my sympathetic nervous system is insufficient, because it's fighting an adrenaline tumor. That's why my heart races. So then we had to look for it. And we spent a year running scans to look for this thing. And Dr. Coughlin would spend half his year in Chile, because he would practice medicine down there and be there, and half in Birmingham. So there could be months where nothing would happen in my case. And the question was, do you deal with a doctor who's regularly not around? You know, we had local doctors and stuff, but if you need a world expert to be the driver of the train, to have the authority and the gravitas to push for expensive tests when nobody wants to run them, you can either have Dr. Coughlin or nobody, and or somebody who doesn't believe what you believe. And so it was like half of Dr. Coughlin is better than all of the wrong guy.
Yeah. Let's talk about the surgery.
Yeah. So then the task is, we get this scan and it shows that my adrenal glands look just like a tumor. So on a CAT scan, they look normal, but on the nuclear medicine scan, they look like a tumor. And so it's like, oh my God, your adrenal glands are behaving like an adrenaline tumor. What do we do now? Well, if we pull them both, you get a new disease. And if we leave them both, you're still sick. And if we pull one, it's like getting shot twice and pulling one bullet. You're not half better. So that those were the models we had, because if you have two adrenaline tumors and you pull one, you might have no positive change in your condition. So we're looking at this landscape and saying, what do we do? I didn't want a new disease. Doctors who take an oath to do no harm don't want to give me a new disease in the hopes that it's better than the one I have, because maybe it is. But also, if we're wrong in some way, now I have two diseases. So that was the battle. And I looked at all this and I thought, the surgery I needed should be simple. Take out the middle and leave the outside. Leave the good tissue, take the bad. And there are partial adrenalectomies. There are ways to take part of the adrenal gland. And so it took me months to just get a good description of why the surgeries that existed wouldn't work. And here was the description. Think of your adrenal gland like a piece of pizza, and then drop a baseball on it. That baseball's the adrenaline tumor. You're going to take a slice of pizza, the slice that has the baseball on it, and leave the rest. Now, think of taking the middle of the gland and leaving the outside. That's a different surgery. So now we think of the adrenal gland like a hard-boiled egg. The yolk makes adrenaline. The outside makes steroids. I needed the adrenaline part gone, and there was no surgery to do that. And the surgery that would work to get the baseball off of the pizza wouldn't work to get the yolk out of the middle of the egg. And that was the hurdle. This is believed to be impossible. But I thought, well, heck, if, you know... So I decided I would invent a surgery. If I needed one and it didn't exist, I would invent it.
I decided I would invent a surgery.
So that was the thing. All the way I looked and I thought, my body is like a car that's out of tune. I didn't lose a foot in a landmine. The foot's never coming back. You know, there was no reason. If this dial could so easily be adjusted by a turkey burger that my life got worse, if it's that adjustable, how can it not be adjusted to make my life better? I don't know how, but for Pete's sakes, all the pieces are still there. We couldn't show that I had widespread neuropathy, that I had denervation, dead nerves. We just looked like a system that was way out of whack. And so it was like, let's figure out how to fix it. And so that was the thought, was if there's a surgical path to fixing this, we just think it's impossible. Everything in science was impossible until somebody did it. You know, nobody knew beans about beans until Gregor Mendel figured out how to crossbreed beans and make a result. And so science was the history of people solving mysteries. And to me, this was the next one. If you're a doctor, you use the means and methods available to treat as many patients as possible. But science is the history of people solving mysteries. So that was the difference. I'm a person. I'm going to solve this mystery.
And how did you solve it?
So I did. So then your task is, how do you do this surgery? And I looked at people, process, and ideas. Maybe the world's best surgeons at adrenal surgery would have an edge, that they could do what other people thought was impossible. Process. Maybe there's a technology we can inject into this process that's better. So I looked at intraoperative ultrasound to give the doctors a second sight to tell the difference between the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla, between the yolk of the egg and the white. And that didn't work. I had, and someone in the course of his, an adrenal surgeon in the course of his daily practice operating on adrenal glands was able to just simply, while he was in there, be mindful of whether this technology could tell the difference between those two tissue types. He said it's very effective at telling the difference between the fat surrounding the adrenal and the adrenal itself, but it's not very good at telling the difference between these two tissue types. And so we didn't need to run a 60-person experiment, you know, with external funding and stuff. We just needed somebody to pay attention to that in the performance of their daily duties. And he did. And so that saved us from, you know, me, how do you get an answer to this question when you're not a surgeon? So I sort of worked with people all over. E.D. Pellegrino was the chairman of the President's Council on Biomedical Ethics. And he's largely seen as the father of biomedical ethics. And he was a professor at Georgetown. And he was my bioethics advisor for about 6 years. And so when I had questions about what doctors could and couldn't do and how to talk about things, I would start with him. I didn't know he was chairman of the President's Council on Biomedical Ethics because I met him before that appointment. So he was my guy before he was George W. Bush's guy. But, you know, I would call him up and I would have five numbers for him because he was at the Center for Fill in the Blank and the Institute for the Future of the something. And so he had all these positions and you would have to start with like, where in God's name is Dr. Pellegrino today? And then you'd have to try and find him. And then hopefully he had time. And so we would talk for 30 minutes sometimes. And these were invaluable because he could help me understand the job of a doctor. And that helped me understand how to talk to these doctors. So that was it. But the big break in my surgery, so that was how to talk about things, but it didn't help us solve how to cut the middle out. And so I found a laboratory manual, a manual laboratory procedure. So a page from a book telling you how to do stuff. That was the lab manual of a biology professor at Georgia State. So this is an obscure piece of information that Google managed to catalog somewhere. And it described the surgery I needed being done successfully on rats. And it was a scant description, a sentence or two. So I called the guy whose lab it was. And he had done it in like 1980, 1978 on rats. So now the surgery that was impossible in Doug Lindsay and humans was possible in rats. And so I took that to the doctors and they didn't.
And did they say, but you're not a rat?
Doctors hate rat medicine. Everything gives rats cancer. You know, everything, you know, rats have short lives. So they all have difficult lives. And rat models of human disease are not always indicative of how it's going to turn out in mom and dad and grandma. So they didn't care. But I kept digging, and then I found the surgery had been done in cats at Harvard in 1926. And I had to track down this guy, and it's Walter Bradford Cannon, a titan of physiology who actually has a mountain named after him. He's a mountain named after him. He had a standing article series in the American Journal of Physiology for more than 20 years. And I had to read most of his articles because he did the surgery, and he described it in less than a sentence, and it's the surgery that could save my life. And he spent half a page on how he accidentally invented the beer bong, half a sentence on the surgery that could save my life. And it led me to believe that he would have described it in one of the articles before that at length. Because if he invented something, he went on at length about what it was. So I had to read all from 1927 backwards, you know, because he did it in 27 and 26. And I had to read all the way back to like 1914, and he didn't describe it anywhere. But we got to know each other pretty well, old Walter Cannon and I, after reading hundreds of pages of his stuff. So, you know, so he was a cool guy, and I actually worked with his biographers, and I worked with his biographers were historians at the Countway Medical Library at Harvard, and I worked with the history of science professor who was the dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. So he and I were exploring medicine's past to try and find out info on this surgery. And he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for writing this book called The Cigarette Century. And it was a genius book about the invention of marketing and how cigarettes, after we learned they were bad, there was the pivot point where marketing was used to make messes instead of help people. And so it was really, you know, so I worked with him and then I found, you know, and so when I couldn't get answers, I took the rat surgery procedure and I had a veterinary pathologist try it on a dead cat. Because a dead cat is not an animal subject and it doesn't require research approval and all this other stuff. So it was just a physical manipulation. Could we take the middle of the adrenal gland out of a cat using the rat surgery? And you could. And then I had the pictures of it. And then we sent those around and everyone was excited to see them, but it didn't convince them. And when he tried it on a mini pig, it did not work. So if it wouldn't work on the pig, it likely wouldn't work on me. But I kept digging, and I found that in 1940, the surgery had been done in dogs. And then we were able to dig from there. And I worked with people at Oregon Health Sciences University, where it had been done there on dogs. We couldn't find out. But the break came when I found, when we got an article from 1923 from Argentina, where the surgery I needed had been done successfully on 11 dogs. And Nobel Prize winner Bernardo Houssay explained how he did that surgery. And so this is what he said. He said he mobilized the gland. Then he sliced into the gland with a sharp Gillette blade and opened it like a book. Then he used a small hard spoon and scraped out the middle, sewed it back up, and that was the surgery. And people were stunned. So that was amazing. But the doors didn't swing open, because saying good news in 1923, an Argentinian did a surgery on a dog, so it's going to, we should do it here at University of Chicago. That was not an intuitive jump. It was unbelievable progress, because we'd gone from a 9-ounce rat to a 9-pound cat to a 60-pound dog, which is the size of like a fourth grader. So we knew the surgery was scalable. And we finally found an article from Denmark where the person had learned how to do it on dogs and then had done it on people. Two people during World War II, and he saved their lives. And it was like, wow. And so I got the surgeon, a friend of mine, head of endocrine surgery at UChicago, who's a bioethicist, and we'd known each other for years. And I said, Homer Simpson was on a softball team in an episode of The Simpsons. And he said, he met Daryl Strawberry, who was an all-star. And he said to Daryl Strawberry, I'm Homer Simpson and I play right field. You're Daryl Strawberry. You play right field. Are you better than me? And he said, well, I've never met you, but yes. And I said, you've never met this surgeon from 1940 in Denmark, but you were head of endocrine surgery at a major research university. You have extensive training, the best laparoscopic, you know, technology that we have at hand, and you were an experienced adrenal surgeon. Aren't you better than him? And he said, yes. And so that's how I was able to move the ball to, is this surgery impossible, to guys we know ought to be able to do it. I ended up not getting the surgery there, and I got it at University of Alabama, Birmingham, where Dr. Coghlan was. But those were the kinds of leaps we had to make. And Peter, the guy at Chicago, he called me. He said something really important. He said, if your body is really that sensitive to adrenaline as we think it is, maybe just take one gland to start. Because if you have two adrenaline tumors and you take one, you might have no change in the patient. But if you're as sensitive as it seems like you might be, maybe if you take one gland, we know you won't get Addison's because the other gland's in place, but maybe you'll get a result. And so that the surgeon at Chicago suggested the alternate course that we ended up doing, which was a stage surgery, taking one gland at a time instead of operating on both, and believing that maybe removing one of the glands would actually change my condition. And that was not intuitive. Because if you pull a normal adrenal gland, Jesse's life is the same as it was yesterday. And if you have two adrenaline tumors and you pull one, the patient might not get any better. But this middle ground of saying, if my condition is as unusual as we say, let's pull one, that took me from wheelchair to walking. And the first surgery took me from being able to walk 50 feet to, by the time I plateaued, I could walk 4 miles.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So that was him doing something that was not common, which was thinking in that direction and throwing out an idea for the smartest people to think about before we made a choice to act. And it was really a special contribution because it absolutely was essential to how it all turned out.
Did you end up having the second one removed?
Okay. I did. And that one I got done at WashU here in town. And that doctor had seen me for 6 years. So he'd seen me for 4 years in a wheelchair. The fifth year I came in dry after I drove there complaining about traffic and walked into his office. And he said, if you're still struggling a year after the surgery, I would find that compelling. And I was, and I was working to build the second surgical team and talking with people all over the country. And he said, I think I can do it. And I think the situation was in his mind, he thought he could help me. how long was he going to sit on the sidelines? He'd seen me for years and he was convinced. And so the first surgery was very much a science-driven surgery. We had blood work, we had scans, we had all of this information, and we had no way to know how the surgery would turn out because we hadn't had 50 case studies before. So it was about making the leap. And in a sense, it wasn't an experimental surgery, but it was like, let's do it. Let's run the experiment. Let's see what happens, in, as a metaphor. The second surgery was an art of medicine play. Like, I was better, but I wasn't good enough. We were repeating the first surgery on the second gland, but pathology had come back like inconclusive. You know, there was no identifiable mess, but if you took a normal adrenal gland, you wouldn't have taken somebody from a bed for 11 years to being able to walk 4 miles. And so this was an art of medicine. We believe this will help you play. And that was the path we used to get it done. And it did help me. So I was able to go back to school and finish. And
yeah. Yeah. What about now? Do you still have any limitations now, or are you?
Yeah, I do. So the problem always, we believed it was two parts, that my adrenal glands were dumping too much adrenaline in my blood and I was hypersensitive to it. And so the question was, well, you know, the first path was, let's treat this hypersecretion of a hormone, because for Pete's sakes, if you have Graves' disease and your thyroid's dumping too much thyroid into your blood, if you have, you know, if you have an adrenaline tumor, if you have an aldosterone secreting tumor, there's a long pattern of saying, let's remove this hypersecreting endocrine tissue and your life should improve. And so that was the path. And until those were done, we didn't know whether being hypersensitive to adrenaline was its own condition. And turned out that it was. And so at that point, we had to use beta blockers and such to rein in, you know, the symptoms I was having. And so now I'm on clonidine and a beta blocker that I chose and worked with my doctor on, and, a handful of other drugs.
Like probiotics. Do you think are you done? Is there more? Or is this it?
I still want to know what's broken. I mean, I think that the beta 2 adrenergic receptor or something in that signaling pathway is what's broken, but I mean, we'll find out. But right now I need to build a business, build a living, and just sort of live a life. And right now time is on my side, because DNA work is getting better and cheaper and more informed by computer learning, but also more informed by data generated from other tests. So waiting 18 months is not something that's crushing to me, because my health is good. I mean, this is the art of medicine, right? In the end, we don't know why you got sick, but we're glad you're better. And so I still have limitations and struggles, but we're glad that I'm better.
What's life like now?
So what I learned was so much. I learned how to build teams and work with all these people. And in the end, I faced this situation of saying, I'm done inventing surgeries. What did I learn? Is there anything? Does this help anybody who doesn't need to invent a surgery? And I came up with this huge list of lessons that I'd learned, and I started pairing them with anecdotes that explained why they were important. And I realized that all the while I wasn't doing the job of a doctor or a scientist. I was doing something new. I was innovating within the health system. I was pairing with existing expertise to get new things to happen. And that was really cool. I developed new uses for 5 existing drugs. We repurposed an animal model of surgery from the 20s and made it a modern human surgery. We did it all in a way that was ethical and that was compatible with standard practice and that got results. And we took our time and we did it right. And we proved that like people could make good things happen even if they were in the system. You didn't have to be outside at a picket line or, you know, with burning torches to make things happen. You could work with good people who had real expertise and transform processes. And so I changed the office visit in small ways so that it would work for rare disease patients. And when I went to Stanford Medicine X last year, I laid out, here are the 4 things I did to help rare disease patients better work with their doctors. And we didn't chunk the office visit and we didn't call anybody names. We started by saying, what could we change a little bit and get a big difference? So that's kind of what I, that's how I applied the learning. And so now what I do is I work sometimes with medical companies, but sometimes just with businesses. And the task is, how do you make a road where there is no road? And how can we take the kinds of mindset that I brought to these problems and apply them elsewhere? And so I build speaking programs, I build speeches to help people understand these things, but I also build workshops that can help managers and leaders lead teams in different ways.
No, that's great. And definitely are going to wrap up with how to contact you. But first, I have a couple other questions that I know this has run long, but I can't not ask these.
Yeah, that's not a problem. And I'm sorry for the listeners if I bored them or something.
The long content, I think, is sometimes even more valuable. But one of the things that, so you're talking about taking this and making it into a meaningful experience. And what I've never heard you say in the times that we've interacted is any anger or annoyance. And the night that I met you, there was a lady that sat down next to you at dinner and literally talked all about herself for like 10 minutes, comparing her tinnitus, the ringing in her ears, to the situation that you had been through. And I would just, again, out of my chair, like, how could you not be annoyed or tell that person that it's completely uncomparable? Like, how do you get to that place where you're actually listening and feeling compassion? Or maybe you're not. I don't know.
So we would, my mom and I would be at home. And there would be a story, and or right up until the end of her life. And she passed away just right before I graduated from college. So she knew I was better and she knew that things were going well. But we would watch a story on the news about the Boston bombing, marathon bombing or something, you know, and she would always ask about the survivors. And then there would be a story, you know, a feel good story on the news or something about somebody that, and she would always ask me, do you think they hurt? So she was in pain and she had a real empathy for people who suffer. And it was very, it cut through everything else and focused on the person, not on John McCain, the senator or the candidate or something else, but John McCain, the guy who has trouble raising his arms because of what happened. And do you think he still hurts? My friend John O'Leary, I don't know him too well, but we went to the same school. He's a speaker and he was burned all over his body and he recovered and he talks about hope and stuff. And she, you know, she wants to know if he's okay. You know, so she sort of laid the groundwork just by me, even growing up, being around somebody so much sicker than me, but who still had compassion and empathy and concern for how I was doing. And she lived that way in the nursing home. People saw the relationship that we had and the nurses and aides and stuff, they would ask her parenting advice and she was worried about them. And so I sort of carry on in that route. It's hard for me to be in public sometimes because I see whose leg hurts while they walk. I see who, you know, I see people standing in uncomfortable shoes and know they're uncomfortable, not, you know, because you can see it on their face. You know, I see. So because I was around my mom and my aunt and because she was, you know, we needed to understand safety for her, I look around rooms and I see things that are hard and I have to sit there at a coffee shop and go, do I get up and help that guy? You know, there's a guy and he's going to walk below a banner and he struggles to move. Does it impinge on his dignity for me to help him without asking? Or is it a gentle gesture? So those are the kinds of struggles. So when somebody tells me something, sometimes it turns out to be important and it shows up somewhere else. And I can tell someone else about tinnitus or what worked or, you know, so I just continually listen and when I was sick, I united my suffering with other people's. And I thought like, what would that person that struggles to find clean water say to me? And they would say, you're in a rich country. For whatever reason, people listen to you, or some people listen to you, you got to keep trying. Because I would have said to them, walk, get the water for your family. I can't walk. If I could, I dang sure would. And so you just end up with that mindset and you end up applying it in a lot of places and you have concern for people and for frailty.
You've been through, so, do you feel obligated to do something really meaningful with your life, Doug? Or do you ever just get tired and think, I'm tired of inspiring other people?
Right. So both, right? So, you know, having inspiring things to say and persisting and trying, those are inspiring things, but you're still just a regular person. And when I drive, I sound like somewhere between a 14-year-old girl and a Buddhist monk. Because it goes like this. So the first one is, I can't believe this person drives slower than I wish, because everyone that drives slower than you is an idiot, and everyone that drives faster than you is a madman. That, I don't know if you've driven, but that's the experience of people on the road. So now you're in this spot, and your first sigh is, I can't believe this person's in my way. And then your second is the deep breath you take to say, I'm the luckiest man in the world to be here. You know, let's remember that we're going to get there either way. And so that's a constant. So that's, you know, so, and it's the same thing. I quit, you know, I blow up when I, you know, like I handle the big mess fine and then drop the pen and the pen falls through the grate in the floor. And it's like,
well, that's a perfect place to end. So, I love it. Let our listeners know, how can they find you? I can't imagine anyone, not a single person in this universe would be sad if they booked you for a speaking engagement. I also want you to plug your movie, because we didn't get there, but World's Tiniest Horse, you got to go there for just a second.
Yeah. Yeah. So my website is douglindsay.net. So that is douglindsay.net. And that is how you can find me. There's a sign up for a weekly newsletter called The Weekly One. Each week I spotlight one article worth thinking about and sort of add my two cents as to how and why it's relevant. And you can find me for speeches, for workshops. I take some of the lessons I've learned and I apply them to the mission that people are facing. And if we talk, it's pretty clear to know whether we're the same kind of people. So if we are, then I likely have lessons that relate to that. Most of my work relates to the role of hope in life and in problem solving, and how that can power you. How joy is the kind of happiness that's compatible with struggle. And that's hard. That's important if you're sick, but it's also important if you're an entrepreneur, because you're trying to change the world. And so walking around with a knitted brow and a scowl on your face is a hard, it might be a good way to get work done, but it's a hard way to live. You can turn around, change the world, and be miserable. You need to focus on moments of joy. And so that's the kind of thing that we talk about. I talk about it in my speeches. I run specific workshops to tackle creative challenges, but I also run more general workshops that teach skills, that teach people the skills of how to make unlikely things happen. And so for me, I like working with companies that are ready to actually make a change. These are companies that can execute on things, and they're at the point where better ideas will make a better future for them, for their company, for the people they serve. People who are 5 years away from thinking, they don't have the impetus to bring me in. But when you're ready to act and you're looking around for, it's almost like, what should we eat for dinner? If you're hungry, there's going to be a dinner. So when you're a company and you're ready to make a change, or you need training, you need people to do things that they aren't doing now, and it relates to the things I can teach about, I can build an experiential workshop that's fun, that runs a bit like a game show, and that leaves people walking away with things they can do that they couldn't before. So douglindsay.net is my website. And to prove that all the team building and such that I did with the doctors wasn't a fluke, in a sense to myself, I came up with an idea for a TV show, and it ended up growing into a movie. So we ended up shooting a zero-budget, accidental, full-length feature film. It should be impossible to shoot a full-length feature for no money. But I was able to get airplane hangers and Ferraris and such. The movie is called Rough Cases. I play a lawyer who becomes internationally famous when he represents a socialite whose dog bit someone. I get nicknamed the dog attorney. And then every client with pet-related issues and more money than sense wants me to be their lawyer. So we got to work with the movie. We got to work with a boa constrictor, with the world's smallest horse, Thumbelina. And I wrote a book. It's too long. It's not published. But Thumbelina has two books. And all the smart things I've said, I don't know if I've ever even said anything as smart as Thumbelina, who says, it's our differences that make us all so special. And you're like,
oh,
even the horse is better at this than me. But so the website is called roughcasesmovie.com, R-U-F-F, like a dog. And it's in post-production now, and hopefully it'll be in the festival circuit sometime soon. It's been hard to get it all done. but it's neat and it's been amazing. And I was able to take the skills that were useful in hardship and apply them in stuff that was pure fun and just get a chance to do the same kind of creativity, but in a way that's fun. Because I don't envy many people, but when I look at IDEO, I'm like, you guys get to do all this amazing stuff. And then at the end, you don't have to risk your own life. Like, that sounds great. So I love stuff like that. I love innovation. I like pairing with people and solving problems.
Oh, great, Doug. This, as I predicted, has been pure joy. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. As I said at the beginning, I hope you've enjoyed every single minute of this, and I dare you to forget this inspiring story. If you have a few minutes today, I would love to hear from you. I know you have some ideas on how we can make healthcare better and put people at the center of everything we do. Please email me at contact@joyofhealthcare.com or visit the website www.joyofhealthcare.com.